Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Christians and Jews, of course, have big religious observances next week, and maybe the non-observant feel left out or just disdainful of the whole thing. So my next guest offers a solution, a Bible for atheists. British philosopher A.C. Grayling has culled the wisdom from the Greeks to Darwin and put together what he calls the Good Book, a humanist Bible. It's organized into chapters and verses, like some other holy books, but there's no mention of any deity or afterlife in it. He joins me now. Welcome back to the show, A.C. Grayling.
Thank you for having me.
You're being described as one of the three leading atheists of today, along with Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, but the nice one in the group. Is this book a case of if you can't beat them, join them and have a Bible?
Almost. It struck me a very long time ago when I was studying the great ethical systems of the world that had the people who made the Bible practiced their art on the non-religious literature of the world that comes from Aristotle and Cicero, from Confucius, from the great atheist traditions, which are very deep and ancient of India, they would have got an enormous treasure house, really, of insight and consolation, of wisdom about the human condition. Had a book been constructed out of those materials, and had that been the book that most people refer to when they were looking for some kind of guidance or wisdom, maybe history would have been different.
The book is divided into chapters like the Bible, some with the same names: Genesis, Wisdom, Parables, Concord, Lamentations, Consolation, Sages, Songs, Histories, Proverbs, The Lawgiver, Acts, Epistles, and The Good. Why did you use some of those same names, chapter names like Genesis that we hear, that we're so familiar with from the Bible?
Well, my book of Genesis begins with the apple falling in Newton's garden, which keys a slightly different way of thinking about origins. This is not intended to be, it's not a parody, and it's certainly not intended to be an attack on the holy books of the great religions. I constructed it this way and used some parallels in order to allow the book to say something about itself, namely that it's a contribution to the conversation we have about the good and well-lived life, a conversation which is a serious and important one for everybody to engage in. So it's somewhat in the same space as those other books, because those other books are used, of course, by people who are thinking deeply about questions of how to live, how to be responsible towards other people. And since these great philosophical traditions have been somewhat marginalized because of the dominant influence of the religions, what I wanted to do was to try and construct it in a way that was similar enough so that people could see here is another way of looking at these things.
So atheists in the audience, or humanists if you prefer, would you read a good book, a humanist Bible? Or if you were writing one, really, really short, what would you put in one? Maybe one verse, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You have your own Ten Commandments in the second to last chapter of The Good. You introduce yours like this: shall we ask by what commandments we should live? Or might we better ask each of ourselves, what kind of person should I be? The first question assumes that there is one right answer. The second assumes that there are many right answers. Do you know them by heart?
Do you know that the point that has just been made there in the quotation you've given is a very important one, because through most of history, people have been told that there is one great truth, one right answer, one way to live. And the thing that we were taught by the Enlightenment is, in fact, that there is a great plurality, a great diversity of ways of living well, because there are so many different talents for living well. And what we need, really, is to open spaces up for people to use the capacities and abilities that they've got to make flourishing lives for themselves and to form good relationships with other people, because, of course, they are key to good lives. And you can't do that if you're all, you know, got to get in line and toe the line and just accept one answer.
So as you write it up in chapter 8, verse 11, love well, seek the good in all things, harm no others, think for yourself, take responsibility, respect nature, do your utmost, Be informed, be kind, be courageous, at least sincerely try.
Well, that last little bit there, at least sincerely try, it looks like a tincture of bathos. But it's sincerely meant, because the authentic endeavor to be courageous, to be kind, to think about others, about the differences between yourself and others, so that you can respect that and allow them their way. If you do that sincerely, if it's a really genuine effort that you're making, that in itself is an achievement of the good. You know, you don't have to, it's like the old cliche that the journey matters much more than the arrival in a way. So it's the endeavor to try to produce something worthwhile,
of course,
that is worthwhile.
Of course, many a Jewish scholar has said, what is the Torah? It's do unto others as you would have others do unto you. The rest is commentary.
they say that, but George Bernard Shaw came up with a very good take on that one. He said, you shouldn't do to others what you'd like them to do to you, because they may not like it. And actually, it's a very profound insight. You know, other people are different from yourself, and if you make yourself the standard for how other people should be treated, then that's a very limiting view.
And maybe the most different commandment in your list from the one in the actual Bible is think for yourself, because that one really says, thou shalt take no other authority above me, God.
Well, that's true. And in the great traditions, we see that perhaps the most important thing you can do is to submit your will to the deity. I mean, Islam means obedience, and the sin of pride is regarded as one of the worst sins in Christian thinking, for example. And so the injunction to think for yourself, take responsibility for yourself, does mark a big difference from them.
A.C. Grayling, author of The Good Book, A Humanist Bible, and Greg in Montclair. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me.
Mm-hmm.
I just have a quick statement to make. It was very interesting learning about the basic philosophies of Buddhism, and I feel like a lot of the foundational information that is explained in the text really brings forth this discussion about just this basic level of humanity and being compassionate to fellow man, that all humans seek happiness, and without going into too much detail of a religious aspect or even a one-track way of thinking, I believe that it's a really good message for the broader spectrum of people out there that are looking for some way to guide themselves.
Yeah, that's a good point. Buddhism in its origin is a philosophy, not a religion, and it's a very compassionate philosophy. It's interesting, actually, that when I was putting this book together, as you pointed out, Brian, I'd gone to the great resources of thinking in all the traditions in order to get texts that I would weave together and edit together. There were some texts from the Buddhist tradition that I brought in also. And the thing that struck me was that the thinkers in the ancient Greek philosophical line, the thinkers in the Chinese line, the Buddha himself, they all of them shared a great deal in common, something which you could describe with a small h as humanism, a very humane and very tolerant and compassionate outlook on things, because that way of thinking about life premises itself on the idea that we've got to have our most generous, most sympathetic understanding of human nature and work from there.
You say in your Book of Wisdom, Chapter 6, the meditation of a wise man is on life, not on death. And on Chapter 8, it has been said that to learn how to philosophize is to learn how to die. Is that a contradiction?
No, not at all. The first comes from Spinoza, the second from Epictetus. The point of the second one is that if you recognize death for what it is, that is, as a final release or rest from the labors of life, you see that it has no fears for you, and then you're liberated from anxieties about it, and you can refocus your attention on what it is to live, and then the meditation becomes a meditation on life.
I think Bill in Dover wishes there were more contradictions in your book. Bill, is that right?
Yes, I'm a believing Christian, and I've called you before. Thank you for taking my call today.
Thank you.
I've taught the Bible, and I've read the Bible, both the Jewish and Christian parts of it, and I've pointed out to the young people I've taught that there are out-and-out contradictions between one book and another. The greatest contradiction is that the Jewish scriptures have a very shadowy afterlife, if any at all. Basically, throughout most of Jewish scriptures, if you die, you just die. whereas the Christian scriptures very resoundingly speak for an afterlife. These contradictions that pass from one place to another, but even within both sets of scriptures.
Why are they important?
What's important is that they force you to think. All right, faith and works, the old, between James and Paul, the Pauline works. You are forced to take on two different points of view, mm-hmm. and you're forced to think for yourself.
Bill, thank you very much. So maybe in traditional religion, you're forced to think for yourself, too.
Anything that makes people think is a good thing. I'm very fond of quoting Bertrand Russell, who said, most people would rather die than think. Most people do. So it's an achievement if you get people to think. But the trouble with contradictions, too many of them, and unresolvable contradictions at that, is that anything follows from them. And it permits far too many interpretations. And one thing one has to remember about the afterlife matter is that, of course, for the first two or three centuries of Christianity, the Christians were themselves either Jews or Gentiles who had been converted. And they didn't have a belief in the afterlife of the kind that we have now, except that they thought that our bodies would rest in the earth and be raised on the last day in a general resurrection. And it was about the 4th century or so with Neoplatonism that the idea of an immortal soul came in. So that's yet another contradiction to add to them.
How do you want people to read the good book? Randomly, or are there books and chapters pertinent to different times of the year, like we read chapters of the Bible, the same week each year? How?
Well, it's up to the individual. I think one of the great virtues of the religious holy writings is that they can be dipped into. You can take a couple of verses or a chapter and you can meditate on it. You can do that with this one, or you can read longer passages. Different books lend themselves to different sorts of treatment. So, for example, the histories in the good book constitute a continuous account of a great competition between a tyrannical outlook and a more democratic one in the form of the war between the Persians and the Greeks.
So can a book that isn't seen as divinely revealed compete in the marketplace?
Well, it's not so much a matter of competition because, in my view, Parnassus, which is the mountain of achievement, is a great plateau, not a peak. So there's plenty of room up there for all sorts of different perspectives.
How are people receiving this in England, where it was already published? Is it taken as an attack on religion? Are people angry at you? Is it being received with a shrug? Are people setting up congregations, if that's the right word, of atheists to get together and do good book study?
Well, so far, but it's early days, I suppose, it's running about 70% warm reception and 30% hostile reception, mainly on the part of people who are not encumbered by having looked at it yet, and they've made some assumptions about it being an attack, which it isn't. I mean, I'll frankly confess that in other circumstances and other writings, I've been critical of religion, and especially on matters of the religious voice in the public square. But this is not an attack on religion. I'm sure that people of faith could find things of use here.
A.C. Grayling, his new book is called The Good Book, A Humanist Bible. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Have a great weekend, everybody. Thank you very much for listening this week. Hope to talk to you Monday. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.